Hi everybody, and welcome to episode 57 of the epic Vassals of Kingsgrave, Song of Ice and Fire linear reread. My name's Bina 007, I'm going to be your host today, and I'm also joined by the Maple adjacent prince, Maple royalty through extended family, White Raven.
Hi, Brett in real life, and not the Maple Prince of anything, but aww, thanks anyway.
But the man who invented the panspermia theory and kicked off this, like, you're literally the first voice on any episode of this reread, so.
I think yours is the first voice, but thank you.
Excellent, okay. I'm also joined by podcast lurker, Amber Rocks.
Hello, this is Amber Rocks. I'm just here so I won't get fined.
But feel free to say stuff. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Like, it feels like I haven't discussed Song of Ice and Fire with you for so long, Amber. So I hope you'll.
That's because I don't have any thoughts. I think about I gotta do laundry later. I think about walking the dogs. I think about candy. That's about it.
Aww. Only the important things.
Exactly. Cheese.
We are also joined by favorite guy from Canada. In fairness, the only vassal I've met from Canada, SJ Lee!
Hello, this is SJ Lee Stephen in real life.
I have to say, the excitement in the girlish fandom over me meeting you was quite intense.
It's the air of mystery.
Yeah, me, Carl, and Casey were very excited about all this. And last but not least, we've got Varley.
Varley Mo Varley.
Exactly. What's cooking today, Varley?
Well, I had lasagna for breakfast that I made yesterday, and I'm brining a pork loin right now to grill up later.
Was it a breakfast lasagna or regular lasagna?
It was leftover lasagna from yesterday, so it was regular lasagna just eaten in the breakfast time.
Nice.
It was
breakfast
really
lasagna
good.
A thing? Because that would be amazing.
I think it is.
Like layers of pancake?
Maybe like layers of eggs and some
pancake and bacon and ham,
sort of like creme fraiche or something.
Creme fraiche.
And then listeners, hopefully we'll be joined in a few minutes by our Viking friend Sir Patrick the Tall, so that will be epic indeed. So in today's episode 56 had epic events. Actually, it was the episode in which Lysa and Littlefinger get married, and also the continuation of Tyrion's trial. So I think that will probably have been a very good episode. We are going to cover some more events from A Storm of Swords. So we are going to cover Tyrion 10, Jon 8, and Jaime 9, and they correspond to the period January 14th and 15th, 300 AL. So we are going to spoil anything from A Song of Ice and Fire and potentially TWA preview chapters, although unlikely. We don't do show spoilers, so you're safe to continue if you're not watching the show. So the last episode finished with Jaime 8. We now jump forward three chapters to Tyrion 10. This takes place on January the 14th and 15th, and I believe it is White Raven with the chapter summary.
All right, Tyrion. Ready?
Let's do this.
All right. Dawn breaks on the final day of Tyrion's chapter. There's one last witness against him, and then he gets to defend himself. He only really sees three options: blame Sansa, take the Black, or let Oberyn have his shot at the Mountain. He doesn't hate the idea of going to the Wall over dying, but he hates the idea of confessing. Pod tells him it's time, and Tyrion asks him if he thinks Tyrion did it. Pod's hesitation is all Tyrion needs to know he's doomed. He's brought to the trial to find Shay is the final witness against him. He thinks, she knows nothing that can hurt me. But Shay proceeds to lie and say that Sansa and Tyrion plotted together and that Tyrion told her it was part of his plot to take the throne for himself. When asked how she knows this much, she confesses to being his whore. She claims that she was forced into his service by Tyrion after sending her fiancé to die in battle. She also says he made her do such shameful things, to which Oberyn curiously asks, what sort of things? Shay, says he used her in every way and made her call him her giant of Lannister, and everyone laughs. Tyrion loses it and ends the charade. He proclaims his innocence of Joff's death, but his guilt for being different. Tywin asks him if he has anything to say in his defense, to which he replies, I did not do it, but he wishes he had. He wishes he was the monster they all made him out to be so he could kill them all. So he demands a trial by combat. When asked if anyone would champion him, Oberyn accepts the challenge. Tyrion now, in his cell, is delighting in his trial's outcome, at least in the making of trouble for everyone. He thinks of Shay again and sings the Simon Silvertongue song and wishes that he knew the rest. Then he went to bed. He goes to see Oberyn in the morning before his trial. Oberyn is cocky as can be. Tyrion is worried Oberyn plans to use a spear for a weapon, but Oberyn claims it'll do. He shows him that the head of the spear is perhaps has poison on it. Oberyn offers for Tyrion to come to Dorne after the trial and says, I'm sure Queen Marcella could use the counsel of her uncle in the trying times ahead, which the fact that he calls her the queen kind of perks Tyrion's ears up. Tyrion toys with the idea of taking up arms against his family if it came to that. And then Oberyn reveals to Tyrion the true purpose of their visit to Castle Rock when he was young for the cock-twisting incident. He explains that his mother planned with Tyrion's mother to marry one or both of the children being Ellie and Oberyn, to Jaime or Cersei. Tywin turned them down and brusquely offered offered Tyrion. She said no, clearly. He tells Tyrion he planned to get justice for his sister and her children today. The trial begins. They fight. Oberyn dancing around the mountain, untouched by the mountain's greatsword. Oberyn tells him who he is and accuses the mountain of rape and murder of his sister and the death of her children. Over and over, he accuses Gregor, and Gregor starts getting more and more mad with rage. Yet Oberyn was still untouchable, unlike the poor stable boy who lost his life. No matter what the mountain tried to do, Oberyn was one step ahead. Oberyn kept pestering the mountain and telling him to say Ilya's name. The viper got several stabs in, culminating with one to the back of the mountain's knee, crumbling the mountain down to the ground. Then Oberyn screamed Ilya and broke off his spear in the mountain's belly, pinning him into the ground. Oberyn, still wanting a confession, does not finish off Gregor. He gets too close, Gregor grabs him and gives him his confession along with his brutal death. And Tyrion, losing his trial, he thinks to himself, I put my life in the Red Viper's hands, and he dropped it. Then he thinks and laughs hysterically when he realizes snakes don't have hands, and the gold clothes dragged him off to the black cells.
Nice.
The end.
Mm-hmm. I just want to quickly say, when you read it, I just got a quick flash to the room. You know, I did not hit her. It was just more like, I did not kill him. Oh, hi, Oberyn.
Okay.
I have a question, quick one as well, which is, you know, when you offer trial by combat, what if the only person who puts up their hand is like Sedontos or someone really shit? Are you obliged to accept them? Or can you be like, okay, I'm gonna go back to like the judicial trial now?
I don't think you have to. I think then it's on you to be your combatant. You know, if you don't choose to pick anybody who offers themselves up, it's you.
Yeah, that still sucks.
Which I think I'd rather take Dontos if I were Tyrion. At least he has some martial training. I thought it was interesting that when they went to Castle Rock to offer up Ellie or Oberyn for Tywin's kids, he obviously said that that they weren't going to be married to them. And if he had married Jaime to Ellie, Cersei might have been queen.
That's only if she married Rhaegar, right?
Right, but Rhaegar ended up marrying Ellie.
Right, because that was part of the Mad King's like extra fuck you to Tywin, was, no, your daughter's not marrying Rhaegar.
In fact, she's marrying this sickly lady that you turned down. Yeah. Well, nobody knew they got turned down because nobody talks about that stuff when they get turned down. It's just gossip. But I don't know who else would have been even in the running.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, weren't Lyza and Kat also like talked about for Jaime?
Yeah,
but I mean for Rhaegar. Like, I don't know who else is in the running if, like, say Elias gets betrothed to Jaime and then he can't pair them off. Like, who's next?
Lyanna
Stark? You think
yeah.
Well, she was next, but do you think they would have done that?
They did anyway.
I get that. I understand, Matt. I don't think that...
No, I don't think that the Northmen and the Riverland people thought that they had a good king, or at least a solid chance there. That's probably why they, after all the wars, decided to, you know, intermarry between each other like that. It seems like it was unprecedented how they married between realms, basically.
Well, that gave birth to like the Southrend ambitions,
right?
Theory
that
or
period
whatever.
Of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm thinking that some of the same thing, maybe not in a scheming way, but at least like, well, at least we know each other, and it seems like a safer bet to just marry our children together and you know, keep it safe rather than
Who's the Mad King married to? Sorry, shocking lack of knowledge.
His sister.
It was his sister?
Yeah.
Then why wasn't Rhaegar to marry one of his siblings or relatives?
He didn't have any until Danny was born. Yeah, and that's what Viserys gets on her.
He gets mad because she wasn't born in time.
Right, because that's her fault.
Yeah.
Hashtag
because they kept having miscarriages, right?
Yeah, I think, don't we get the first instances of Targaryens being born like really, really deformed?
I'm pretty sure the Mad King had a bunch of miscarriages, though.
No, but I thought the miscarriages were like had wings and shit like that.
Wasn't that back farther back in the day?
Yeah, that happened hundreds of years ago too, Varley.
Yeah, but we're talking.
Isn't there something about Sons of Dragons as well, isn't there?
But we're not talking about it historically. We're talking it literally, like in the literary sense that it's the first time we hear about it, right? But then again, I don't know if that's actually true. I think.
Well, no, not literally, because we hear Dany's head wings, and that was way before that.
Oh yeah, good call.
Damn. Okay.
Well. Oh, sorry, bro.
The prince of derailing shit today.
It is the Vok way.
We walk things up.
But it's a pretty straightforward chapter other than that little sidebar they have. It's not, I mean, they have the queen there. They plan on queening Marcella. I thought that was interesting read it.
So do you think, so it sounds like he directed his sand snakes to make that happen, or did he direct Arianne, or like, because eventually they move in that direction anyway. Right.
I think Doran had it planned to do that. I just don't think he had it planned to do it yet.
Interesting.
Because he talks about how him and Oberon were closer together than anybody else knew.
Right. He was a tall grass that hid the snake.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That didn't have hands.
What a weird detail to end on.
Yeah. So maybe it was just the show, but I found it surprising that this chapter, all this action happened in one chapter. I thought they were separate, like trial versus trial by combat, but that is not the case.
Imagine my surprise when I started reading it.
Having volunteered to do the summary. It is amazing. Like, as you get to this part of Swords, he just absolutely rams in content, and it never feels rushed, but he really does move forward with plot.
I don't know. I do feel like it picks up, like, as the when they have the trial, it's kind of clunky. But then once, like, they start fighting, it almost, like, when you're reading it, it kind of, like, picks up as you're reading it. Or you, like, have to read it faster, it seems like, to me.
Right.
Anyway. He keeps accusing him.
Yeah, and I think that kind of develops a cadence and kind of makes everything a little more, like, you know, frenetic or frantic. And, like, the pace does keep on going. And then I remember the first time reading this, just being psyched. I'm like, finally justice. Like, let's get to this. Like, I want to see this motherfucker die. And then.
And you saw the wrong motherfucker die. Yeah.
You didn't smell a trap?
No. I was a sweet summer child back then.
I didn't either. I thought he was going to kill him. I was like, oh, what's going to happen? You know, you're like reading, you're like planning out what can happen from there forward. Like, oh, Tyrion's going to get away. And I doubt they'll let him go to Dorne, but let's see what happens. And then pop goes Oberyn's head and it all changes.
Yeah, this is after the Red Wedding, guys. You got to amp your cynicism.
And the Purple Wedding.
I'm not sure you can still be a sweet summer child permissibly after the Red Wedding. Sorry, Amber.
Yeah, exactly.
You can still hope for good things.
Well, it's written so well, that roller coaster. I'm like, yes! No! Did anybody predict that he had poisoned him? I don't pay attention.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Did we just assume that?
Well, doesn't Tyrion mention like the blade is darker or whatever?
It had some oily substance on it. Yeah, but you know, he's like, Oberyn is just dominating him, and then he just gets too close.
Oh, and then George writes it like they embrace like lovers or whatever, and it's just like, oh no.
Oh, yeah, no. He holds him tight, a little too tight. I just love how. We're going to talk about John's chapter. It comes up again with Noi, but it's like these characters that he throws in for such a short period of time that you just love them so much because they're so great. And then he just discards them like, well, I'll make up a new character next time. And I love it and hate it at the same time. I keep coming back.
Were any of you, when you read it the first time, or I'm not sure if it's the show that's changed me, I wasn't really that moved by Shay's betrayal this time reading it, but I was the first time I read it. Like, that was what I really remembered from this, rather than even the Mountain versus the Viper. And I somehow feel that maybe the reading of it in the show, or her, has sort of diminished my respect for that relationship. But I was really into it at the time, and I don't know. It kind of just didn't really affect me, which was surprising.
Well, this just brought up, like, more of the theory that, like, was it just mere coincidence that they began that relationship? Was she something, like, you know, obviously we know she's, like, banging Tywin eventually, or at some point she started doing that, but, like, the first time I read it, it was, like, just kind of an organic relationship, and this was, like, the ultimate betrayal, but I don't know. Now on the reread, it seems like, okay, is this relationship set up, you know, for the ultimate downfall of Tyrion?
Oh my goodness. I never thought it was set up from the beginning. Have I just missed something massive? I thought that they got together and then eventually Tywin found out and exploited it. I didn't realize it was potentially
if that had to happen, then Rock had to be into it. You know?
Right. Which is why he doesn't stand to be his champion.
Really? Braun. I thought it was Braun. Yeah, Braun, yeah. Did I say Brock?
Yeah, you did. We don't speak that name.
Sorry, I just watched Pokemon like a few hours ago.
No excuse is good enough. Move on.
Braun, okay, and Braun are basically the same characters.
So Braun, he seems impartial to this. I mean, how would he possibly have survived?
At what point do you think Tywin took him over? Is it when he made him a knight?
In the first book, when they first arrived to the camp, like, you know, he could have got
That's when he got Shay.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I just don't think Tywin would have taken him seriously yet.
But no, I can see the point in it, because in any case, it seems like Tyrion is the center of all the problems there. Well, him and Jaime, but Jaime isn't like a person to fuck around. He only funks one person, but so in that sense, it seems like it would be prudent to have a plant within a spy within Tyrion's inner circle.
The sad part is Tyrion's not even a problem for him. I don't think he's not plotting against Tywin. He's doing everything he asks him to.
Yeah, but he keeps on making problems for him without trying. You know,
how
getting abducted by Catelyn.
I don't see how that was his fault, but okay.
See, I know it's not his fault, but then again, Tywin has something against Tyrion. Right?
You mean killing his wife? Yeah.
Yes.
And being a cripple. I wonder if he would have treated him the same way had he not been a cripple.
What, that it was one offense or the other might have been okay, but the both of them were just too much to bear?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, if he came out as Jaime 2.0, would it have been
as
bad?
It would be fine.
I kind of think so, too. It's just like his wife was sacrificed for a dwarf. I think that's what gets him the most.
But it really depends, doesn't it, really, if that another theory is true as well. Because even if it's not true, if Tywin has a suspicion that it might be.
Right, then the chance that it could be true.
Yeah, exactly. Then that's even worse for him, right? That some bastard.
The other theory is that he's a Targaryen, are we talking about?
Yeah.
Why so coy, Patrick? Like, to say the theory.
Let's all allude to things and dance in circles.
Well, I don't know. Seems fitting, right? Dancing around the mountain and then
landing on your own spear.
Yeah, basically. Aerys actually did force himself upon her, or, you know, somehow got in bed with her. Or at least there's a rumor around about it, and Tywin has heard it, then the suspicion itself could be enough, coupled with the other things, to sour him against Tyrion.
Right, he's like, I gave birth to two perfect children, and this comes out? That's not mine.
Yeah, couldn't be mine, yeah.
But I can't prove it.
He didn't actually give birth to them, in fairness.
Yeah.
It's a team effort, okay?
I bet he wasn't even in the room.
No, didn't women have, like, a seclusion period, like, where they'd go with their, like, ladies-in-waiting to the birthing room?
I know Robert went off on a hunt whenever she was in labor.
Well, yeah, that's because he's a prick.
And Craster just yelled to keep it down.
Yeah.
Those are my two experiences of childbirth in this world.
Let me utter the immortal words. Anything else on this chapter? Stephen, do you have thoughts on this chapter? Take us home.
So I've been rereading the book, not with the whole podcast, but on my own. And Shay's character comes across really quickly as, like, she's not in love with him and the writing is all over the wall. But even still, reading the testimony, I think you get another side of Shay. Like, she is like a convincing liar in this scene. And she pulls out all these little hurtful details, like twist the story. And I wonder how much of that was a fabrication by someone like Tywin or Cersei, or how much she came up with it on her own. When you read the testimony part, I feel like you have to kind of recast Shay.
Yeah, everything she says is just plausible enough to be true. Even this, like, even the lies, they're like mixed in with stuff that's true, and it's really tough. And that's, I can see why Tyrion would be so angry, just because it's like, that's a lie, but you can't be like, oh, she's lying. Like, maybe you're lying.
Did she or did she not call you Giant of Lannister, which we are all now mocking you for? It's like,
yeah,
she did.
Yeah, she did, but it wasn't my choice. Right.
And didn't Bronn steal her away from another knight in camp? How do we know that wasn't her fiancé that she speaks of?
Oh, please.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I mean, we don't
know. She's too good a whore right from the beginning for that to be the case. Like, Tyrion says she doesn't bat an eyelash at him being misshapen or anything like that. So she's been at it.
I think we're meant to just see her as the female version of Bronn, right? She's very clever. She knows what she wants. She knows that she's at a disadvantage in this world, and she's going to use whatever she has to get whatever financial reward she can. I think the fact that Tyrion is so hurt and betrayed by the inevitable betrayal of both Bronn and Jay just shows that for a guy who's so smart, he's quite credulous. He just wants to be loved so much that he doesn't have a lover in the wrong places.
I don't think Bronn betrayed him so much as just he's not willing to give his life for him.
Yeah. Well, Tyrion surrounds himself with basically mercenaries, right? Like, Shae is paid to be there. Bronn is paid to be there. The mountain folk are paid to be there. And then when he can't pay them anymore or they find a better opportunity, they leave him and he's shocked by their change of heart.
So for a guy who's so smart and witty, why are you so shocked? I mean, I just think it's either tragedy or... I don't know. I think it's probably what makes him so lovable, because he is really smart and we really admire him for being witty and perceptive, but he has this deep vulnerability that must come from a very deep set need to be loved and a very deep insecurity. But it's
awful. Part of it is the thought that he doesn't think he can be loved. He doesn't think people would love him. That's why he throws money at everyone. And
he's a Lannister.
People who want money. Well, he's got money, but what I'm saying is he doesn't believe that people would actually like him for him. That's why he has to pay everybody to stick around. The only person that's ever liked him is, in his eyes, is Jaime.
Hey, you're forgetting about Pod. Pod's a fucking man. He wasn't getting paid. He wasn't even getting trained.
Right.
He was just there for him.
I'm kind of curious if he had asked Pod to stand up for him to champion him, if Pod would have done it. I think he would have. Oddly, he would have died.
Enough to do. Yeah, oh yeah, immediately.
But I think he would have done it.
Really?
Like, he was so hurt that Tyrion left him.
Yeah.
Because he left everything. Once Tyrion left, he left everything to follow Brienne.
Sure did.
I mean, maybe Pod and Tyrion are very alike, just very lost and very in need of love.
No, Pod's stupid, but he's loyal.
But he's also pain, so he is a pain. That they had like a really bad history with the Targaryens and everything, and they seem to have an honorable history with the Kingsguard and stuff like that. So I'm guessing that they do have like some sort of a knight's code embedded like in their family culture.
The House of Pain rules.
Jesus. I don't think you can call Pod stupid though, because like he is he's a boy. He's very young. I can't remember how old, but he's a child. And he has like a stutter or something like that, or he just has terrible nervousness. I don't think he's a moron. Like he memorizes all the house shields and all that other stuff in a previous chapter, right? He has a brain in him. He's anxious.
And a lot of that is from Tyrion helping him, which I don't think anyone's ever done in his life.
Isn't he with Tyrion because like the guy he was squiring for stole a ham or something? He's loyal enough to steal from Tywin Lannister, but not smart enough to know not to do that.
He's still alive.
So, after Tyrion 10, we go back 6 chapters to Jon 8, which takes place on the same day as the duel between the Mountain and the Viper, October 15th. And I believe it's January the 15th, well spotted, Lekka.
Which is also my birthday.
Yay. Nice. And I believe we have a very epic and unusual chapter summary from Varley.
Oversell it, jeez.
Yeah, no, shit. Stage fright here in a second. All right, so I read this chapter and I thought that it in a very short, well, not a very short chapter, but in one chapter, we get almost a complete hero's journey. Okay, so hear this out. So the hero's journey is 12 stages, and I'll kind of preface each stage with what happens in the chapter. The first one is the ordinary world. The hero is uneasy and uncomfortable and unaware. So this is kind of like that weird dream that he's having where he's back down in the Stark tunnels and he feels not wanted because he's not a Stark. And then we get a weird image all of a sudden of a direwolf with golden eyes with blood on its fangs. And then he wakes up, which is the next step, the call to adventure, where he's literally called to an adventure with the horns. The refusal of the call. The hero feels fear of the unknown. So that's him like waiting for like the cage to come down. And he's like, oh boy. But he's kind of like, he looks around and he sees like all his bros with him. Meeting with the mentor is the fourth stage. And this is him with Donald Noy. You know, he sees leadership. He sees Donald Noy tell the fucking priest to shut the hell up or he tosses his ass off the wall. crossing the threshold. So this is when he is now given control of the wall, I think. Okay, so he's given control of the wall from Donald Noy while Donald Noy goes down. 6 is test allies and enemies. So this is the first kind of nighttime battle. and he kind of is able to lead them through that. The approach is you find newfound allies. So these are just like the Brothers of the Night's Watch, especially like Satin and stuff, really stepping it up. The approach is newfound allies, and this is kind of where they continue to fight, and he's like, you know, telling them that like we're up on the wall and you're all down there, and like he kind of like riles up everyone. The ordeal would be the second attack during the day. He gets through that with the reward of thwarting the day's attack, and he gives the wall over to Gren, which is a hilarious part because no one can believe that Gren's now in charge of the wall. 10 is the road back, and this is him coming back down to see what happened in the tunnel. The resurrection. So this is where they are purified. I don't really know what this is yet in this chapter, but it's kind of like the transition of when he tries to get out of leadership and says like, oh, well, this guy's the last knight on the wall. And he's like, well, no, because he's actually demented. Oh, well, why don't you take charge? Amon says, no, like, I'm here to give advice and, you know, guidance. I'm not a leader. So then that ends with the return with the elixir. The hero returns home and continues the journey bearing some element of the treasure, which is leadership. And now he's the leader of the wall until the garrison returns. And scene.
Which actually kind of justifies Tanya's hatred, not so much of John, but of the John story as being the conventional hero's journey. I mean, that just fits in really well, like spookily well. Right?
Good job.
A couple things that I wanted to talk about was just the kind of interplay of the way this chapter progresses. Very like, it started off kind of mystical and like in that dream sequence that has this imagery that is kind of dark and disturbing. And then we get the fight scene where there seems to be a lot of confusion. Like one of the first orders that Donald Noy says is like, throw pitch so we can see what the fuck is happening. So they don't know if it's like 100 men or 100,000 men. And then, so it's very like dark and obscure. And then when the day starts, like you see the, you know, the enormity of this army. Like he wasn't like, it isn't only 10 mammoths, it's 100 fucking mammoths and like all the giants. And like you get like the craziness of battle and then everything else. And then like it takes a break for a second to like explain that, you know, a guy comes up with some onion broth to feed the archers, like which I loved. And yeah, and then it's just like, you know, John kind of rallies the troops, he makes it through the first battle, and then it's like peace. Yeah, so I like this chapter, but what do you guys think?
I think Donald Noy is amazing. And like I said before with Oberon, I love how he can take a character that's so like almost just breezes by. I know it's been a while since we met him, but it's almost like they breeze by like Corrin Halfhand and Donald Noy and Mance Rayder, how they're like very sidebar characters, but they're so good and so well thought out. It's just, I hate when they, well,
gone.
Mance isn't dead, but the rest of them are just, they're gone so quick.
But again, it shows you the talent, doesn't it? Like, just the, think of how many lines of text Donald Noy actually gets. It's so minimal. And yet I really have this strong sense of who he is as a man and an admiration for him. And he feels so fully rounded to me. And that's the talent of George, I feel, that he can so quickly, briefly essay these characters.
Exactly.
I feel like one of the great things that some people do better, and I think George is one of the good ones at this, is to make characters that seem like they existed before the story started, and they have like a backstory, and not even just people that existed, but maybe even you have now, right now we're seeing that from the point of view of the characters, we're seeing like new heroes emerge. But there's always been heroes in the realm of Westeros. And these characters you just mentioned, Oberyn, Halfhand, and Dol Guldur, those were those kind of people. They were the heroes before the heroes, basically.
Right.
And that's,
I don't know if Donald Noy was ever a hero, but I know what you're saying. Like,
well,
he was,
he did lose now. his arm in battle, right?
Does that make you a hero?
I think that's presumed, right?
No, Noy is kind of this legendary character because
I know he forged Robert's hammer.
Yeah, like he's a blacksmith who forges the hammer that Robert uses in Robert's Rebellion. He loses his arm at Storm's End, and then he dies battling a giant at the wall. Like,
well, yeah, that part makes him a hero. But I mean, at this point, like he's just
But I mean, like, he's a larger-than-life figure. Like, he's been attached to so many important moments in Westeros history that you have to imagine if the place wasn't in utter chaos, there would be, like, the Ballad of Donald Noy and, like, the legend that he is this, like, kind of small folk hero.
Doesn't Tormund say that Mance will write him a song because a one-armed blacksmith killed, like, Mag the Mighty, and he's like, oh, that'll be a good song.
Yeah. I think his ability to make you care about characters in such a short period of time comes from his short story telling. Like, he's a good short story writer, and I think that's the kind of thing where you have to develop a character quickly so you can tell a story. Right. You have to develop him in a few words.
But also from a role-playing perspective, I know that he's an avid role-player, and the whole thing of making characters that seem like they existed and maybe even were heroes in their own time, that's like one of the staple things you can do to make the world living, basically.
Right.
Something to aspire to, basically.
Like you just said, Patrick, now, like, the first thing that came to mind besides Donald Noy was the actual tavern keeper that we see, like, for a second, and then she hangs for, like, three books in the very first one, where it's like, all of a sudden, this woman with gross teeth, like, we know, like, all about her because Catelyn remembers her from, like, when she was a child and how she didn't, like, you know, come into the inn to stay. And it's like, this person that's just a non, you know, has so few lines, like Bina said, like, is already established in this world as this specific tavern keeper for, you know, a generation.
I think having good tertiary characters who have connections to your broader world makes the world feel alive. And it often feels really cheesy when it's your primary characters interacting with each other. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about? Like, it always feels a little awkward where it's like, oh my goodness, Sam meets Bran and sneaks him through the wall. Like, how lucky is that? It's like, yeah, okay, this is fine. Or Jon and Bran and the rest of their companions meeting at that tower. Like, it just feels like too much of a coincidence.
Like, you get Brienne meeting, like, Shadrach and that other, like, hedge knight, and it's like those kind of characters just, like, met on the road, and you get, like, all this awesome backstory.
Mm-hmm. Right, if she had just met the Hound there, you'd have been like, come on.
Right.
Or that, another good example of this is that ship. I think it's the Cinnamon Wind that is, like,
that's
traveling
everywhere.
Around. That's everywhere. Yeah. Like, these little details that are like, no, there are other people going on their own journeys and have their own histories too, that besides our protagonists.
The same thing just on the other side with that boat that Theon took over that was, like, held in harbor for 6 months and then, like, tells Rob what happened.
One thing I would add to that is that not only are they on their own journey, they don't necessarily care about what the main characters care about. They're basically, oh, well, that's fine. Now hear my story. I'm not really that much interested in you. This is me, you know, at least. And then when they then eventually reoccur in the story for some reason, You've got a taste of them, and now they get expanded upon, and you kind of feel feel familiar. So that's a very good way of doing it, I think.
Yeah, and you get those, like, little Easter eggs, like with Thomas Sevenstrings, like, singing for Edmure, or, like, Shadrach showing up in the Vale, or, you know, like, you met these people for, or, like, the dwarf that, like, Brienne talks to for, like, a hot second in a wine sink, and then, like, it's his body that is, like, brought to Cersei as, like, this one was Tyrion. Like, yeah.
Also, the smith, which Gendry worked under, he's, like...
Oh, Tobo Mott.
Yeah, Tobo Mott. He reappears, like, several times.
He gets thrown out of the city with the antlers, like, nailed to his skull.
Though the battle is impressive and good on the Night's Watch for holding off the wildlings, it really does show how, like, bare bones their operation is, and, like, they barely survive this fight, and it's hard to imagine, like, if any more serious challenge comes, if the Night Watch would be able to withstand it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was actually quite scary. I hadn't realized just how flimsy the defenses were until I read this. It's just horrific.
Well, luckily they only have to defend one passage.
Yeah, in a 700-foot wall. But yeah, I mean, there's that moment in the chapter where he's like, this, you know, ragtag group of misfits, like, became men of the Night's Watch, like, you know, overnight, and they're defending the wall and defended it. I like that dude, Spare Boot or whatever. He's like, oh yeah, I got shot, but in my fake leg.
And it kind of adds to the almost mystique the Night's Watch have, because all these wildlings are just, like, throwing themselves against the wall, and they threw them back. Yeah. You know, and they're just like, they're untouchable. We can't beat them. I'm sure it really hurt their morale, even though they didn't do anything, most of them.
So there's a couple of things, like Bina said, like how woefully unprepared that they are. John's like wishing that they had like 20 trebuchets on sleds so we can move them around, not two, and one broke down. And he's like, and also a dragon or three. Like,
oh. And then, like when they're riding up on the thing and he's like, oh, we can only get up 10 guys at a time. And I'm thinking to myself, well, they only need three trips and you should be all set. And everybody's on the top of the wall.
Yeah. And then there's another kind of like Easter eggy thing that is like he describes going into the tunnel, like going down the gullet of an ice dragon. And I'm just like, stop it. I was told there'd be no ice dragons in the story.
There is one, Matt. It's a constellation.
The first reason I came on to the reread episodes was to complain about how stupid the ranging was. And I'm going to use this as an opportunity to, as evidence for this proves how stupid the ranging was, because the wall is a massive force amplifier. So if they had those 200 guys around still with extra crossbows and swords defending the wall, this would not have been such a desperate holdout to the last man kind of fight.
But they wouldn't have known they were coming.
I knew they were coming.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you could see like 100,000 people coming down. Like
they knew they were disappearing. Like the wildling camps kept being like abandoned. They didn't know where they were. That's why they went to find out what the wildlings were up to.
They took their entire strength with them to do it.
Yeah,
I think they took half the men. Was it half?
Yeah,
they took 300 men total.
5 men,
2 and 1, like 200 from one, 100 from another. But they still have like 600 at the wall, though, right?
Yeah, but those are like the farmers and blacksmiths and shit. Like, they're not the warriors.
All they gotta do is pull back a bow.
Like, it's so easy.
Well, they're standing at the top of the wall. Only one of them even got hit.
I mean, from 700 feet up, you could drop arrows and you'd have a pretty good chance of hurting someone.
I mean, yes.
Wouldn't a penny, like, kill someone?
Drop from that exactly.
Height? Throw I mean, pennies from that height.
They had to defend the gate, but... And they almost got through with just one giant, but they didn't.
Yeah, so what military strategy was that for Mance to like be like, just hit it, but we need to hit this one gate that's really important? Like, shouldn't they have drawn off, like, fainted more? Like, that's what he's doing, which is draws off, like, the garrison, right? And then it's just, like, throw everything at this one gate, and then we'll figure it out?
Well, they were supposed to have people on the inside that took the gate over before they even got there.
Ah, good point.
Or at least divided their attention.
And that's part of, like, I know the ranging didn't work the way they planned it to, but because they went on the ranging, they actually did defend this better than they would have if they hadn't gone on the ranging.
Hmm.
I'm not saying...
Although 4 people, or 7, 8, 9 people wouldn't have done much against a force of 200 at the wall, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, if all of the people that went on the ranging didn't go on the ranging, you'd have a lot of people at Castle Black, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that would have been, the people that climbed the wall would have been sufficient to, you know, be able to open the wall and whatever.
Well, they did have spies.
And their whole point is that, you know, there's no defense on the back end of the castle. So, like, once you're over the wall, like, attacking the castle is super easy, right?
Yeah, because there's no defense. I mean, it's not like you can't defend it, but you're more vulnerable.
Right.
But they did have spies. They knew how many men they had at the wall.
But also, I want to continue being devil's advocate on this one, because actually, the only people that made any difference pertaining to that was John and Corin Halfhand's group, right?
Right.
So a small ranging from the big ranging was the ones who actually found out what was happening.
And I think that was Steven's point, is like, why did you need such a huge... And of course, he just left for a second. why do you need such a huge group? Like, it's so stupid when the work of, like, even... you figure, like, a traveling camp of, like, 50 guys. Like, 300 guys were not going to knock out an army of 100,000 or just...
But they didn't know it was that many people. They didn't know it was every wildling north of the wall.
Yeah, all right.
But they know that the wildlings are moving south.
But I'm not saying it was a good idea. All I'm saying is it's kind of defensible how it worked out. I'm not saying it worked out the way the Lord Commander had planned it, but they did need information, and every scout they sent out wasn't coming back.
Mm.
Valid point.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed to send out 200 just to get one scout back. And that was what turned the tide and saved the wall, so...
No. That is a false conclusion right there.
How about the Molestown people? Like, some of them went back from the protection of Castle Black to do what? Fuck. But some joined. Those guys are heroes.
Yeah, like Satin.
And Zay, the only chick that's badass with a crossbow.
Some feel comfortable with just, you know, being in Molestown doing whatever they do there. And some people like killing as well.
Yeah. Just on the side to spice things up a little bit.
Well, a hobby.
I wonder if a certain extent, like, this battle kind of proves the actual worth of the Night's Watch to these people. Like, before, they're just this weird order that lives above them, standing on a giant ice wall for apparently no reason, because there has been no threat for hundreds of years.
They come off the wall to fuck them in most
time. Yeah, like, they make a living off of the Night's Watch, but I don't know if they, like, respect their mission, and all of a sudden they see with, like, oh, these guys are actually defending us, so there might be a little bit of prestige suddenly rubbing off on the Night's Watch.
Right, they're just a bunch of horny dudes, and now they're fighters. Okay, we get it.
Yeah, exactly.
If they win, if they keep the wildlings out, nobody cares because their life goes on as normal, and if they lose, nobody cares because they're going to be fighting them, and, you know, they're not going to have time to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're like, congratulations, you did your job, way to go.
Right.
What do you want? Well, it was bigger than that, but okay.
I just think they're screwed either way, reputation wise it's been too long that they've lost respect.
Well, everyone, how long has. Was it last since last time? Wasn't it 3 or 4 generations ago, the last time
the wildlings came down?
Yeah,
I mean, they come down in fits and spurts all the time, but last time there was a king at north of the wall?
Yeah, I think it was it the Horn King or the Redbeard?
Shit.
Am I going to have to fucking look this up?
Well, either way, it didn't work out for him.
It's interesting, though, all right? Because I think I remember something about, what, Rickon Stark?
I think it, like, the time of Duncan Egg, aren't they going up there because, like, there's a wildling threat, or is that the Greyjoy threat?
I think that's Greyjoy threat.
According to a wiki of Ice and Fire, ooh, Raymond Redbeard.
Hey! Nailed it!
Let me say the damn factoid. Raymond Redbeard. Raymond Redbeard gathered the wildlings in either 212 or 213 AC and breached the wall in 226 AC. They were defeated by the Starks and Umbers at the battle at Long Lake. So it's not within living memory, really, but there have, well, unless you're Maester Aemon, but there has been a king beyond the wall fairly recently.
If Aemon was there, and he was, why the fuck doesn't he come with any other counsel than just, well, you should just ban the walls, basically? I mean, he probably knew more than just that. Maybe he even had his sight at that point. Like, he could have seen what happened and then say something that'd be useful.
But his role is guidance, so it's like...
Yeah, but okay, he guides a little more, right?
Right, but, like, maybe he had, like, a marshal, like, first lieutenant that's like, let's do this ranging, it makes sense, like, let's do it. Like, that one guy who's like, oh yeah, we'll carve them up and they won't be a force for another, like, 30, 40 years. What was that guy's name? Shit.
Welcome to the Wilding Research Podcast.
Venus, it rains. Venus.
I think that the point is, though, that the Night's Watch doesn't have the capacity for a bunch of military options. Like, they don't have, you know, a cavalry regiment that they could send out there, like Stannis brings, to break up this army. They have to just man the wall and maximize their own defenses. That's like, right. They don't have a ton of options. Offensive. Yeah, exactly. So it's like, stand on the wall and try to, you know, keep them out, because the wall is our primary weapon here.
Yeah.
But I'll say, not knowing anything about what your enemy's movements are or what they are doing really hurts you when the wall is as long as it is. And you do have 3 gates that they could come at. And they were sending out, like, shadow forces to, like...
4.
Huh? They have 4 gates?
At the Night Fort, there's a secret brother gate.
All right. Well, Mance isn't coming through that one. Even though he might be able to.
He was a brother.
Anyway,
I said it in the magic gate thing. I was like, I don't know how that works.
With the 3 gates, they could, like, send out shadow forces and get you to move your guys around. Because that's, I mean, you still have to defend, but you don't know what's coming.
Yeah, you need intel of some sort.
But... And that's what they weren't getting. And that's why he was getting frustrated. Anyway,
yeah.
So, Stephen, I said that, like, if they sent out a ranging party of, like, 50 guys, they would have been able to accomplish the goals that they eventually accomplished.
Yeah, I would accept that. I don't accept sending your entire military component out on a suicide mission.
A third.
Anything else on the chapter? After John 10, we jump forward 9 chapters to Jaime 9. This takes place on the 20th of January 300, and I believe it is SJ Lee with a chapter summary.
Yes, thank you. So this is the final Jaime chapter of A Storm of Swords. In this chapter, Jaime reflects on the events and dealings in the Red Keep and struggles from multiple game-changing events of late. He meets with Cersei and Brienne and decides it's time for him to shape his own destiny. So a little more detailed breakdown. The chapter opens with some of King Tommen's early official actions, stripping House Tully of their ranks and positions, and River Run is given to Emmon Frey. Ramsay Snow is legitimized, and Roose Bolton is named Warden of the North, and the Westerlings are rewarded for their treachery. With the decapitation of the Kingdom of the North and the Trident, some of the River Lords submit to King's Landing. Jaime is in a sour mood as he is bored and reflects upon his inability to fight after practicing with Adam Marbrand. Tommen seems a delightful child under the puppet strings of Kevin and Tywin Lannister. Jaime bumps into Jane Poole masquerading as Arya Stark, and we learn she is to be married to Ramsay Bolton. We also learn that Sir Gregor is rotting away and, despite his victory, looks ready to die soon, which may be for the best given the political situation with Dorne. Cersei visits Jaime. She seeks to use Jaime to regain political control, especially over her son. They also discuss Bran, and we gain some insight into the earlier plots in A Game of Thrones, and they conclude that Joffrey was likely behind the assassin to kill Bran once he was unconscious. Tywin and Cersei wants Jaime to resign the Kingsguard and take up his role as heir to Casterly Rock. Cersei attempts to seduce Jaime, but he resists and she storms out. Jaime and Brienne meet, and he tells her about the truth. And they discuss Tyrion's pending execution. He gifts Brienne Oathkeeper and sends her away and asks never to see her again. Brienne asks why he is freeing her to seek out Sansa, and he responds, "I have made kings and unmade them. Sansa Stark is my last chance for honor. Besides, Kingslayers should band together." The chapter closes with Jaime inscribing his entry into the White Book and concludes that he will be the author of his fate from now on.
What a great line.
Yeah.
I think it's a great line that Tommen calls him Sir Uncle.
Oh.
Well, Tommen's fucking adorable. So
I love Tommen. Tommen is great.
If in a different world, if Jaime was his father, would he call him Sir Father? Because that would be God fantastic.
So. Sir Pop Pop.
I don't know, because I remember watching Deadwood, and one of the characters, like, his son calls him Sir, and, like, Mr. Bullock sometimes.
Yeah. But it's not his real son. Yeah.
That's true. It's his nephew, son?
Yeah, it's his brother's
God, son. I need to rewatch that.
Does it seem weird to anybody else that a warrior like Jaime wouldn't train with his opposite hand before this? You know, just in case something happened to your dominant hand in battle?
Yes, you your question.
Or is that just...
How often do you write with your opposite hand, just in case?
Hey.
Well, I doubt I'm going to, like, have something happen to my good hand while I'm writing.
So the pregame.
How many people do we know in this world that have hands chopped off in battle? I mean, I think, and also add Corrin. To that Jaime is, one. Jaime didn't really know, and add to that the fact that Jaime is quite arrogant. He probably just thinks I'm so good in battle it'll never happen to
that
me.
That would never happen.
Yeah.
Okay, I get that. It just
Dal Noy,
like...
maybe he had a chance.
I mean, this is the guy who pushed a kid out of a window. I don't think he lives his life sort of calculating risks.
Worried about consequences.
mitigating risks.
Yeah. Like, I know Jamie's older, but I kind of imagine him as, like, a cocky 20-something who, like, the burdens of life have not yet touched him, though this entire book series is about him confronting difficulties within life for the first time.
I like that Tywin is worried about Stannis, and it shows how formidable he is.
What, Stannis?
Huh?
That Stannis is oh my god, I can't speak.
Formidable. Yeah, like he's worried about what Stannis is doing and why he's not where he thought he was going to be.
Yeah, I didn't put that in, but Stannis's forces have left Dragonstone and Jaime and no one else knows where they've gone. I think someone theorizes it might be Tywin that he's gone to the Stormlands, maybe to raise up the Stormlords again against them.
Well, don't they hold Storm's End and that's why they thought like he left like 200 guys there?
Mm-hmm. Stannis loyalists still hold Storm's End.
Right.
I just appreciate that he's worried about Stannis, even though everybody else has already written him off. Tywin's still thinking about it.
I think if you look at the logic of the War of the Five Kings and who the contestants were, Tywin always knew Stannis was the most dangerous one. I think he underestimated Robb, but like Renly, he knew he wasn't a serious challenge unless he managed to actually move his army.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then there was Baelon, which is not a serious threat to King's Landing.
But is to like Lannisport and Casterly Rock, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, he could have messed things up quite a bit if he had actually stayed with the Starks, or not stayed with the Starks, actually gone with the Starks.
But I think Tywin knew what he was dealing with Baelon. He knew he was never going to roll with the Starks.
I don't know. I don't think I think he underestimated the whole North situation completely. So, yeah.
Yeah, I want to also add that I don't think that Tywin is so smart that people actually make him out to be. I think he's some of the things are slightly just him having this reputation, and that sort of precedes him and gives him a few advantages when he deals with people.
I absolutely agree with that.
I was going to say, this is exactly what Stephen and I were talking about in Toronto, literally.
Maple Moot.
I wasn't.
Yeah, and like I didn't comment on it when we were talking. I didn't comment when we were talking about it, but the idea that Tywin like put Shay in Tyrion's tent that night before the Battle of Green Forks is kind of crazy to me. Like it just shows, like it's you're allowed to have smart characters who can see things in advance, but that's insane. Like right, that's
super villain.
Yeah, that's, oh, I control, I don't only know what's happening everywhere, I'm controlling what's happening everywhere. And Tywin makes a lot of mistakes, and frankly, the Lannisters get lucky in the War of the Five Kings on numerous occasions, and that's why they win.
Right. No, and I agree. I think he's a capable manager. He just has the means to kind of have the biggest army. So, okay, he could lose a battle, but in the end, like, he still has more guys than the next guy or whatever. I find that theory interesting about Shay, but that's like, you know, 12 moves ahead in 3-level chess or something kind of like.
Yeah.
I think Tywin knows his enemies most of the time. Like with Rob, it was kind of a wild card, and that's where he had a blind spot. But he does a pretty good job otherwise.
No, but I mean, like, he even has that, like, little dickish comment where he's like, oh, the young wolf pup wants to play with the lion. Like, we'll show him. And
that's what I meant by a blind spot.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But also, I mean,
I thought you meant the movie.
I don't think he counted on Oberyn, for example, you know, supporting Tyrion in trial combat, stuff like that.
I don't think anybody did.
Yeah.
No, but yeah, I'm saying that he doesn't have complete control at all times, and nobody does. I mean, some are good. Well, actually, that's not true, because, I mean, we see Varys and we see Peter Baelish. They both do a lot of scheming and have a lot of contingency plans, but I don't think that Tywin operates at the same level as they do.
No, not nearly as backdoor-ish, I don't think.
Well, like...
Oh, my.
Shit. God damn it.
I would compare like Baelish and Varys to like a tech startup compared to something like IBM that has, like, the big houses have this like infrastructure, and like they can't pivot easily without, like, you know, changing things that have been around since, you know, the Age of Heroes or whatever.
I gotta say that this is one of my favorite kinds of chapter of person barely paying attention but tons of things happening all around them. Like basically everything Jaime learns about what's going on in the North is the basis for A Dance with Dragons book 5. Huge things happen in this chapter, but Jaime's like, I'm sore from fighting. I don't want to be here. It's kind of those classic Sansa chapters where she's thinking about something else, but clearly huge things are happening all around her.
Yeah, and you really appreciate these kind of chapters, like, when you do a reread, because it's like, oh, it was all right there. Like, how did I not pick it up? Oh, because he was, like, yeah, whining about, like, fighting Adam Marbrand instead of, like, paying attention to what Tommen was stamping.
Though this is interesting, because we start to see, I know we've seen a little bit of it before now, but the fracturing between Jaime and Cersei become pretty clear in this chapter. Mm-hmm.
Well, after, you know, what happened in the previous meetup when they first met up, like, it makes this very interesting, like, him, just refusing her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think this is probably the first time Jaime has ever refused Cersei.
Yes, I think so.
And probably. I don't think she took it very well.
No, and I think this is part of what's going to go into Feast for Crows as being this very interesting shift in the power dynamic. And him coming to kind of self-realization apart from her. Like, he can be someone apart from what she wants and what their relationship is, which is fascinating.
And what to her was just a throwaway line of Tyrion lies to you, I lie to you, is really going to just eat at him later.
I think she implies she has affairs too, doesn't she?
I don't think that's the case, but she definitely says, I lie to you all the time.
Well, in any case, there's also the whole thing. Yeah, you talk about this is probably the first time he has refused her. But also, whenever we hear her think about him, it's basically like she is very focused on herself and him being like a mirror.
She controls him.
Yeah, controls him, but a mirror to herself, basically. I get like she's focused on herself, while he sees them as one person at least, or something. Like when he thinks about it to begin with. Now he's like he chooses to become his own person. So he's like he's finally being separated from his twin more so than before, right?
Doesn't he still flip flop about that though? Like he's like to Edmure, he's like I don't give a shit about you. All I care about is getting back to Cersei, and then like he leaves the tent and goes off with Brienne.
Mm. Yeah, but I think this is part of the start of a journey of him separating himself. So it's not immediate and it's not linear either.
Mm-hmm. No, it wouldn't be. I think unless something really horrendous happens and you're just like, okay, I'm done with this completely. You would also be like flip floppity about, you know, breaking up with your longtime girlfriend,
part-time sister,
forever time sister, longtime girlfriend.
Oh God!
Cersei tells Tywin here that Tywin is sending her back to the Rock. Now, do you guys think Tommen would have been better off with Cersei or Tywin? I mean, obviously none of this actually came through. Do either one of them really care about him? Or is he just the claim that they want?
Well, Cersei's his mother. And, you know, like I think Varys says, like, I think she loves her children more than anything. But she's also a fucking insane person. So either you get kind of a detached father figure that will mentor you into like some Machiavellian like political leader, or you get this narcissistic. I think it hasn't come out so much yet in the books, but when we get her POVs, like she is very paranoid and like everyone's out to get her, and you know, very much believes that like her name should be able to get her status, and I don't think that's very healthy for him either. So it's really like a 50-50.
Well, part of her paranoia is Tyrion getting away and killing her father.
I think that paranoia existed beforehand, just because the whole point of her killing Robert was she was scared that she was going to be replaced, which we know that Renly was trying to do that, but like...
Well, get replaced and kill her children. I actually think she, as far as the quote-unquote murder of Robert, I think she went about that very cleverly, actually. The whole, like, just get him really drunk while he's on a hunt. Can't blame us. I think that was a very good alibi.
Being Lan's soul and then doing him afterwards, it's not like...
But Jaime was gone. Who is she supposed to do? You can't do your family.
Anyone outside her family.
Keep it in your pants. That's one of the things you could do. You could, yeah, I don't know.
But you've seen it with Cersei. That's how she kind of gets what she wants. She thinks it's her only way to get men to do what she wants them to do is use her body.
Yes. So my point is she that clever then? I mean, it was a clever enough idea, but the execution of it hinged on her having sex with her cousin.
Had she had sex with him at that point?
No, but it hinged on it because then he would keep silent about it. The other thing, right?
I guess. I mean...
She could, if she had maybe tried to like use other means of like coercing people to do this deed, and maybe not having a connection specifically to the Lannisters through her cousin sending, you know, forcing all these squires upon Robert that has a direct connection to House Lannister, there would be maybe less thought that it was the Lannisters that had a finger in it, right?
Yeah, I think the part we're missing in this conversation is that Cersei wants power for herself. Like, yes, she cares about her children, but like her objection isn't that Tywin is mistreating Tommen. It's the fact that she's being shut. Like the first complaint she gives Jaime, I'm pretty sure, is I'm not allowed in the small council meetings anymore, or they're excluding me from them, right? So the complaint isn't like Tommen really should focus on his studies in this area and I'm concerned about his rearing. The concern is like I'm not being able to exercise power anymore.
That's a good point.
So do you think like the whole conversation with her and like her attempt to manipulate Jaime is like, please apply your pressure. I'm going to manipulate you into applying pressure so I can come back into power, or at least start to exert force again.
Well, her whole like thinking is that she should be Jaime, and the only reason she's not is because she's a woman, right? Like,
I mean, that's valid. I mean, for her to think that.
Oh, of course. I mean, she sees everything that Jamie's afforded and is jealous. But
the irony is that most of the power related stuff that Jamie's afforded, he rejects because of her. So
right.
She wants his opportunities, but she certainly doesn't make the choices that he's made.
Well, I mean, as far as status goes, she's arisen higher than Jamie ever can.
But with unless you think
Jamie will be the king someday.
Yeah, her power derives from whoever she is wed to or has as children. So she doesn't have any real power. Jamie now is basically for lifetime, he's like the highest military counselor in the realm.
And bear in mind that as the books open, she's convinced that Robert's about to put her aside for a younger bride. So her power, such as it is incredibly fragile.
Do you guys think Tommen would have been better off with Cersei or Tywin?
I vote Tywin.
No, Tywin. Neither. Tywin?
Can I vote Kevin?
Ooh, later. Kevin, that's a good one.
Kevin better, yes. But Tywin? No fucking way. I mean,
look how Kevin's children have turned out so far. It hasn't been great, but some of that is because of Cersei.
Most of them are dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's basically because of war and Cersei. Not so much because of Kevin.
I think Sir Pounce should raise Tommen. Just let him alone with his kitties. He'll make the right decisions.
I just was wondering if one of the options was for him to be with Cersei at Casterly Rock. If Tywin had just said, okay, go to the Rock and take your kid with you, would that have removed kind of some of her poison and allowed her to just be a mother and focus on him, even though she's still fucking crazy?
He'd already said that she'd messed up raising Joffrey and he wasn't going to let her mess up another kid, right?
Yeah.
Which is fair. It's hard to hear, probably, as a mother, but fair.
Yeah, the state's going to have to take this one away because the last one was a monster.
Is it fair, though?
I don't know if it's fair, but I get the logic. But clearly, Tommen hadn't turned out the way Joff had at this point.
Joffrey had a lot of things not going for him, basically.
He had everything going for him. He was royalty. He had the best nutrition, best teachers, best, training. He didn't have to live in...
Okay,
necessary.
Let's just break it down at least, because his mom prompted him to, yes, there's a thing there that must have been most of it, but there's also his absent dad. That would not have been a problem from now on, right? I'm thinking that in this situation, Joffrey isn't just... He wouldn't have been a normal boy, even though he had a like a different sort of upbringing. He did show, signs of having, problems relating with people like that might have been, congenital or something like that, or at least from birth. So I'm thinking that he was just a bit of a psycho, right?
Seems it.
But it was exacerbated by his mom and his dad being the way they were.
I have a feeling about Joffrey, and I'll just put it out there, that it's not uncommon for someone to confuse strength with cruelty. And I think Joffrey grew up in Robert's shadow and saw him as this strong warrior person, but interpret that as cruelty. Like, hurting others is what makes you king.
Maintaining control.
Yeah, exactly. So, he knows his father is this incredible warrior who only respects strength and has all these war stories. So of course he picks on Tommen, and of course, we kind of get the story of the logic between why Joffrey would kill Bran, because his father thinks the boy's better off dead. And Joffrey decides to take things into his own hands. Like, Robert didn't really mean it. He means it's a shame the boy didn't die, not someone should snuff out his life, one assumes, right?
Yeah, but which is fair. But then you get the butcher boy kind of thing where he's ready to kill him just because of practice sword fight. I think he had, I get what you're saying, but I think he had more propensity to cruelty regardless of how he saw his father.
Also, it's just, I mean, this would be a valid thing to, a valid reason if he were six, something like that. But he's a teenager. He has some sort of, ability to empathize with people and have, I think he's...
But what context, does he had? I mean, a teenager is still young. I'll use the same defense I use of Sansa. It's still a young age. And he's been brought up, always heir to the throne, fawning, sycophantic people who will never show him discipline. This example of parenthood that's horrific on either side. And as Stephen said, sort of conflating strength with arbitrary cruelty. Like, he thinks being willful is somehow monarchical. And I don't know. I mean, I don't really want to mount a defense of Joffrey, but I'm just saying he's also effectively just exited being a child. And he's also just grown up in a very bizarre situation. Maybe sympathy.
It's always a discussion about nature versus nurture, but I think it's always a combination of the two.
Right.
And that's basically what my thinking is.
If we're going down like the he was idolizing Robert, like what explains Ramsay Snow then? Like maybe that's like the thing where it's like a good, like obviously Ramsay Snow was a bad seed from the beginning, right? And then maybe Joffrey was a mixture of nature and nurture or something. I don't know.
I don't think you're going to dig to the bottom of this philosophical question here.
Well, no, just because Ramsay Snow's father was never around and never knew who he was until just a few years ago, right? And then he killed his real brother, or when Domerick found out that he had a half-brother, like...
But I suppose...
We should call up George and ask him to drop whatever he has in his hands right now and write an alternative history of what would happen to Joffrey if he'd had a nice childhood. I think that would have been better than whatever we could have gotten from him, right?
Well, he's not writing Winds of Winter, so...
Guys, that's not very nice.
I mean, whatever wild cards he's about to put out. Yeah,
I think the mystery we get is like when you contrast Joffrey to Tommen and Myrcella, who seem like incredibly pleasant, decent kids, but they're not three of the equal. Like Joffrey grew up his whole life being the heir. Right. So I think Beenham has a good point where like kind of the toxicity of both parents, you know, you get that Lannister pride that everyone is below you and no one can touch you and you are, you know, they're the greatest person in this entire kingdom. And then you get the like might makes right from his father's side. And then I think that there is some evidence in the text that, you know, maybe he is a sociopath or a psychopath, whatever the correct terminology is. Like he enjoys seeing pain in others or has trouble empathizing with other people.
He mutilated the cat. And that's a big sign. And also he did weird stuff with Tommen, because that's a part that like got cut off in the books where it's like, oh my God, like what the fuck is going on?
I think you can see kind of how like the way Tyrion treats them. Like he thinks Joffrey's a bad egg, but he thinks Tommen and Marcella are just greatest kids ever. I think we can take something out of that. In fact, he obviously thinks Joff is a shit. I don't know. I don't think it's like Patrick said, it's probably a combination of both nature and nurture, but you know, he might have a chemical imbalance or something, but I don't, he's the way George wrote him. It's hard to analyze his character other than that.
Some people are just pricks.
Not anyone here though.
No, we're good people. Yeah. Well balanced.
Something else in this chapter, my favorite line Jamie says in this chapter is, there was a time I would have given my right hand for a sword like that. Now it appears I have. And I love that line.
Jamie has some nice caustic humor in this chapter. I remember the Jamie and Brienne meeting being more amicable. So I was waiting for a line that sort of supported that memory, and it's really not there. He's very cold to her, and he basically, like, I think we all assume he feels differently than what he's saying, but he's like, take the sword, get out of here. I don't want to see you again. By the way, try to uphold this oath.
Right.
Well, she did also call him Kingslayer, which he's asked her not to call him.
Yeah, and then she calls him Jamie, and then she says it's Kingslayer, remember? And like,
so yeah, it's just he is cold with her, but I think it's because he wants her to leave. He doesn't. She seems to just cling to whoever gives her what she needs, which is, you know, purpose. And he's trying to give her purpose away from him.
Mm-hmm. Seems like a lot of the people we've talked about these last few chapters in this book in general have issues, like daddy issues, sister issues, mm-hmm. or mommy issues.
Imagine writing a book, Patrick, with people with no issues, and just be like, he woke up, he had breakfast, went to work, came home, made dinner, went to bed.
Yeah. No, stuff could happen again. I mean, you don't have to have a issue with your daddy or a mommy to be interesting. You can have other faults, but it just seems like a lot of them have like these things that are grounded in like an absent parent or something like that.
I'm sure you could point to evidence on the other side of this, but it does feel that, you know, Game of Thrones and A Clash of Kings to a great extent are about external conflict between individuals or groups. And then as you move into Storm of Swords and especially A Feast for Crows, you start getting more internal conflict, people dealing with like their own struggles. You know, you can especially see that with like Arya and Sansa switching identities, Jaime going on this personal journey.
I was going to say a lot of this is actually shown in your chapters, Stephen. Like the war is ended. Essentially, like all, you know, wartime conflict is done. So now it's like, you know, the reconciliation of like, what do we do now? How do we move forward? And then so, you know, the conflict has to be internal, right?
Mm-hmm. It's actually interesting because this doesn't feel like peace, right? But I guess that's the reality. Like it's messy and unpleasant. They have to, you know, put people in new places and try to figure out how it's all going to work.
But also right. It fits into the whole, you know, adventure story arc. There is the first few books are the arrival of the mysterious stranger and the plunging into adventure. And then we have like the trials that sort of reflects what the hero needs to improve in themselves to, you know, become what he needs to become to overcome the big problem, right? So this in this book is basically the trial for a lot of these characters. They're dealing with whatever they need to deal and try to.
Are you talking about the hero's journey again?
We thought George R. R. Martin was so subversive.
These things are traps. You, as a writer, you fall into them whether you want to or not.
But we expect them to be like that, and that's how we feel comfortable with them. So even though he might change a few things up, I think it's a wise choice to you know, follow form. That's basically with music as well. We don't like suddenly change the form completely. At least we can do that, but not all people will like it as much.
Agreed. Mm. That seems like a nice place to end this episode, unless people have other stuff on this chapter.
It's a hell of a trio of chapters.
It was a great.
Yeah. Mm. It reminded me a lot of Shellfish, actually, because I remember very strongly the Wolf cast where we did the Mountain versus the Wiper. It made me a little bit nostalgic for our fallen comrade.
I mean, that was good television. Like, I never had been so disgusted and, like so hyped up and, like, knew what was coming. I knew what was coming. And then, like, the way that they did it, like, ugh.
I still remember that it didn't use a shield. Atrocity, I would say.
Right, or a sun disc on his head, right?
Yeah, nothing good. Nothing other than just plain old, you know, playing with his spear in front of everyone.
Also, the mountain wasn't wearing a helmet, so
yeah.
When you're fighting to the death and you have the option to use as much armor as you want, you always want to leave your head exposed.
And this is VOK brought to you by Nadia in absentia. VOK.
Nadia. Hashtag PSA, Nadia.
Always wear a helmet. Silly not to. I'm gonna take it that we have nothing else sensible to say on these chapters.
Yeah, that's
very fun chapters.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to close out and we can watch it. So thank you very much, everybody, for joining us, including White Raven, who has fallen in battle. But thank you also to Patrick, Pat, Stephen, and Amber, who did not just lurk but participated today. That was like so exciting.
Well, it doesn't count if I just say silly things.
Yeah, exactly. For those following along at home, the next episode of the reread is a very cool one because it's the only one I think we'll ever have where there are three chapters we'll be covering and all three are from three different books in the series. So it's going to be Danny 2 from A Dance with Dragons, The Captain of the Guards from A Feast for Crows, and John 9 from A Storm of Swords. So logistically tricky to get all those books together and make notes, but I think that's going to be really interesting and it's where the linear timeline really, you know, does its thing. And that's going to be hosted by Mary Nymeria, I believe. You can follow us in the meantime on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, WordPress by searching for Vassals of Kingsgrave. And indeed on iTunes, if you feel like giving us a kindly review and rating, please feel free to do so. It helps people find us. To get involved and maybe participate, but certainly chat about the content, if you search for A Podcast of Ice and Fire, you can join the forums there and that's where you'll find us. So with that, I can close out the episode, but does anyone have any forthcoming episodes they want to pimp out?
Can I pimp out a separate project, please?
Yes, you can.
Okay, so me and a buddy of mine, he started a writing project. It's called any3words.com, and we're doing an associated podcast with it. Basically, it's for people like me and him who have industry jobs that crush our creative souls. So we do stuff like go on Vassals of Kingsgrave or start this writing project to get a little creative. It's any3words.com. It's just, you get any three words, a name and a place, and 30 days to write whatever you want, like whether it's a haiku or a short story. Like, just get it out there. And, you know, we're trying to just build up a fan base and try to get this rolling. But I think it's worthwhile, and I'd appreciate it if you went there.
Sounds really cool.
Very cool.
Yeah. Any other episodes to pimp out?
Well, there will soon be another call to arms for Stranger Things Season 2 reaction or summary podcast. So look out for that.
That's great. I listened to the first half one and really enjoyed it. So, and it was perfect because it had just, by coincidence, I just watched that far, but it was really great. So I look forward to that.
Thank you. So yeah, join if you want to.
Anything else from anyone else?
So I've been watching the show Mindhunters. It's fucking amazing. I would like to do, I'll throw up a CTA on the forums about the show. And then I've personally fallen down a Ed Kemper rabbit hole. And I would like to talk about him as a serial killer a little more. So if anyone's interested to join, I'll be hosting, and I'll probably send it to Bina to curate if she's not on it anyway.
Yeah, I'm happy to be on. I think it would be really interesting to do an Ed Kemper crossover episode with like a Mindhunter review, because I think we've both fallen down the same rabbit hole on the back of that. So
thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Cool. Have a good night, everyone.
Bonsoir.
Bonsoir.
Bye, thanks.
Bye.
Emmanuel Kant was a real piss, and he was very rarely stable. Heidegger was a boozy beggar who could think you under the table. David Hume could out-consume Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. And Wittgenstein was a beery swine who's just a schloss to Schlegel. There's nothing Nietzsche couldn't teach about the raising of the wrist. Socrates himself was permanently pissed. John Stuart Mill on his own free will, on half one shandy was particularly ill. Plato, they say, could stick it away. Half a grain of whiskey every day. Aristotle was a bugger for the bottle. Hobbes was fond of his dram. And Rene Descartes was a drunken fart. I drink, therefore I am. Yes, Socrates himself is particularly missed. A lovely little thinker, but a bugger when he's pissed.
I just wanted to bring something up first. I don't know if this was covered in the last one because I haven't got to listen to it yet.
Badass.
But
the last one hasn't been recorded yet. It's actually being recorded next weekend.
Okay. Well, there was one that they were talking about how they always refer to Cersei as the Lannister. And I thought we talked about it on a previous episode, and somebody brought up because the person marrying into the royal family doesn't take the royal family's name. Is that true, Bina?
Don't know.
Well, with Queen Elizabeth II, he didn't, right? And that was a whole big thing to, you know, maintain the House of Windsor or whatever.
Like the children maintain, they get the royal name, but the queen doesn't because she's not actually of the royal blood.
The show is in, not the show, the books are inconsistent on this.
Are they? Do they ever call her Cersei Baratheon?
No, but Catelyn is called Catelyn Stark all the time.
But that's not true. A royal family. It's not a royal family.
Yeah, that's well, kind of
is. For all intents and purposes, the Lords Paramounts are the equivalent of kings, right? So they should observe the same conventions.
I think Stannis would disagree.
Liza Aaron, right?
But he's not a king. I'm kind of curious, when Robb was the king in the North, did she take his name?
Jane Westerling?
Yeah, wasn't she still a Westerling? Did they never referred to her as Jane Stark, did they?
Unclear.
My brain says no, that we don't
see. I trust Stephen's brain. It's kind of Targaryens because they were Targaryens. But Elia was always Elia of Dorne. She was never like Elia Targaryen, was she?
I'm not sure Jane Westerling was around long enough for us to see her referred to in a courtly setting as a Stark or a Westerling or anything.
Well, we got her fucking hip size twice, so there's time
for
just
that. Thought somebody brought that up previously on another reread. Or maybe I just heard it somewhere else completely.
We were talking on one of the episodes about sometimes, like, when you marry to some, if you're a girl and you're from a very noble house and you marry to, say, a less noble one, you might keep your name and double barrel it. So that's how the Spencer Churchills happen in real life. But I think how it works in England is that Queen Elizabeth is just, she's of the House Windsor, but she's just Elizabeth II. Like, but she doesn't have a surname. She's not Elizabeth Windsor. But all her kids and the husbands have surnames, so it'll be. But they never use them. So I think when they go to the military and stuff, like Prince William used, because he's the Duke of Cambridge, was William Cambridge. Weirdly, it's weird.
But didn't what's his name Philip have his own house name that was just made up, like Montebaum or something?
Do you mean
he was Mountbatten. Well, he was really Battenberg, because they all had these German names, and then the war broke out. They're like, shit, that's a bit unfashionable.
They basically freedom fried their names.
Yeah, he was the royal family was Saxe-Coburg Gotha, and they changed it to Windsor just randomly after a random castle. And Battenberg became Mountbatten. But that was a huge thing for him, because he wanted his children to be Mountbatten Windsor. And if you believe the Netflix series, the Queen was like, I'm the only guy in England whose kids don't have his surname. But yeah, you know, you marry a queen, deal with it.
I don't think Marjorie Tyrell has ever called Marjorie Baratheon.
See, I think the problem with this, Brett, is for comparison's sake, Marjorie was a Baratheon for like 2 weeks. So, like, she's better known as Marjorie Tyrell.
She's married right now to Tommen.
She's still Marjorie Lannister or Baratheon.
I don't think they ever call her by name.
And that's, I think,
like,
they just say
Marjorie, Queen Marjorie. I don't think they ever say Marjorie Baratheon or Tyrell.
How does she sign her checks?
Yeah. Queen Marjorie? Maybe it's just because there's not enough information. But I thought somebody had brought up before that when you marry into the royal family, you don't take the royal family's name.
I don't think that's right. I think you must take the name, surely, because that is by default. It's the royal family. It's the higher house. So why would you?
But no, I think you don't take the name because you're not actual royalty yourself. And then if your kids get it, but you don't yourself.
And then there's all sorts of conventions about not necessarily everyone takes someone else's name in a marriage. Like, and countries have different traditions on this.
But I will bow to the one that actually has kings and queens, and you're probably right, Dean.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that that's what George is doing. And also, even if George is inspired by England, it's probably some medieval version that was totally different. The sort of person who would know this stuff is Sarah Dr. Blood, like medieval literature expert. She probably knows this. So Sarah,
she's really smart.
Somebody's
like intimidatingly smart.
I'll Skype ask her.
Yeah, but she wears it very lightly.
She might be the one that brought it up.
Yeah, exactly. This is exactly the sort of thing she can help us out with.
Do you want me to record? Actually, last time apparently it was only me being recorded when I sent a recording.
Only the important ones, huh, Matt?
Yeah. We can call out hashtag Greg for standing us up.
See, I'm not sure hashtag Greg really has to us up. I think I just asked him about 10 times, did he want to be on? And he politely refused to answer positively or negatively. And then I thought I thought bullying would work. I thought if I just added him to the Skype thread, he'd just sort of feel obliged to show up.
It's like Greg was added to this conversation. Greg left this conversation. Greg was added to this conversation. Greg left this conversation.
I have ended up on episodes because a call started and I had been added to a list, so I just went anyway.
Exactly.
It's very effective peer pressure.
Someone is breathing heavily.
It's Brett.
I'm typing, not breathing.
What, me? I was on mute, drinking Dornish Red.
Is it better?
Yeah.
I just stopped breathing. It'll be fine. Keep going, guys.
Keep it up.
And of course, my wife apparently is moving furniture right now, so...
Are you sitting on that furniture? Is that what it sounds?
No, that's just my awesome mic, man. This new mic is amazing. It picks up everything.
Well, then it's not amazing.
Well, that's not very
nice. I saw it. I touched the mic, and it's amazing.
Okay.
Yeah, White Raven was in my bed earlier this month.
Okay.
That was my bed.
I was in Amber's bed.
Oh, my.
Yeah, come on.
Can you just say flip-floppity again?
Flip-floppity? What?
Yes.
Brilliant.
What is it? What's the problem with that? Is it because
it's so adorable?
I don't like being patronized, but then again.
I don't know. I'm completely serious. I don't know about Varley.
Oh, I found it adorable, too.
But I do think...
White Raven, did you cut out?
He did.
You just don't think
he just fell off the side of the planet.
You know, it's funny because he said, I think, and therefore he should be, but he thought, and then he
should be.
Existing.
he should am, but he's not.
Brett, did you think yourself back into existence?
White Raven.
If White Raven falls over in the middle of a forest and no one is there to see, did it ever happen?
The Maple King sees everything.
Emmanuel Kent was a real pissant. He was very rarely stable. Heidegger was a boozy beggar who could think you under the table.
David Hume.
Are we drunk?
There's nothing Nietzsche
couldn't teach
about the raising of the
wrist.
Socrates himself was permanently pissed. Okay, then.
What were you supposed to know to
out? If I had background music to know what I was supposed to do.
Half a pint of shandy was particularly ill, and Plato still and sick of what was fun.